Welcome to The Good, The Bad and The Dirty, The Secret Psychology of Persuasion. My name is Natalie Nahai and I'm the web psychologist. I help businesses psychologically optimize their online engagement by applying scientific rigor to their design process. In The Good, The Bad and The Dirty, I'll be sharing strategies and tools with you that you can use to enhance your online presence. Listen weekly as I share new sites, news in online persuasion, and the occasional guest star to help you convert more customers online. Make sure you subscribe for free updates at thewebpsychologist.com and get all the resources we mention in the show on the show notes page at thewebpsychologist.com/show-notes. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Good, The Bad and The Dirty. This week, our guest is Carl Honoré, an award-winning journalist, author and TED speaker and globe-trotting ambassador for the Slow Movement. Carl is a prolific writer whose first book, In Praise of Slow, examines our compulsion to hurry and explores a global trend towards kind of putting on the brakes. His second book, Under Pressure, was hailed by Times as the gospel of the slow parenting movement. And now his third book, which I've just started reading and would highly recommend, The Slow Fix, explores how to solve problems in every walk of life, from business and politics to health and relationships, without falling for short-term, superficial quick fixes. Carl, thank you so much for joining us on the show. It's a pleasure to have you as a guest.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
So as this is a podcast about the psychology of persuasion, I'd love to start by asking you how, in an increasingly fast-paced world, you've managed to persuade people to slow down long enough to pick up your book and kind of consider whether their current approach to life is serving them.
Well, there are probably two sides to the equation. The first is that in order to persuade people, they have to be ready to be persuaded. Mm. And I think that we've stumbled into a moment in history now where people are fed up with their lives being every moment a race to the finish line or a dash to beat the clock. And I think wherever you go nowadays, more and more people are waking up to the fact that there's too much speed in the system. So the world is ready. And it's not just aromatherapy cooperatives and yoga retreats who are talking about the benefits of slowing down. No, it's the biggest companies and some of the fastest moving, most cutthroat sectors of the global economy, whether it's Silicon Valley or the city in London or Wall Street. People are starting to realize that faster isn't always better. So I guess in a sense, how do I persuade people to read my books? They're already ready and primed. The second part, I suppose, of the answer to that question is that part of it, I think, is how you phrase things. I think language is very, very important. Mm. And also the messenger, him or herself. I think because I am myself quite a fast person anyway, that makes it easier to make the case for slowing down in a weird, paradoxical sort of way. You know, if I were a kind of proto Dalai Lama with a shaved head and a yoga mat chanting om, that wouldn't really go down that well. Whereas I live in London, I have tight deadlines, I like the adrenaline rush of a big city, I play fast sports, I talk fast, and I think that probably helps some people feel more comfortable with the message of slow, that somebody a bit like them, who has clearly gone through that whole process of identifying the virus of hurry and conquering it, is, you know, I think that brings you people around to your way of thinking, or at least to want to hear what you have to say.
And that whole thing about feeling as though you're someone who's perhaps a bit more familiar to people that could most benefit from slowing down, so those of us who are completely always in the fast lane, goes a long way, I imagine, to also building trust that people need to be able to hear such kind of a, I would say revolutionary message, because it still is. I think even though there's a need for it, it's difficult for people to be able to accept the medicine when you deliver it. What's your experience been with that?
Well, it's certainly true. I think revolutionary is a big word, but I think it's apt. I do reckon that we need something big and sweeping now that's going to shake the culture to the foundations. And as you say, the culture at the moment remains profoundly anti-slowness. The taboo against slow is still very deep and abiding. Slow is a dirty word in our culture. It's a byword for lazy, stupid, even unproductive, boring, all those things nobody wants to be. So I think revolution is an accurate term for describing it. People, it's funny, I suppose people want to hear what they, to some extent, they want to hear what they already know or what they're starting to suspect in their own lives. So, and they want to hear from somebody who seems, as you say, familiar, somebody who seems in the same world or moving through the same context that they do. I mean, if I lived in a bothy in the Highlands and grew organic carrots and was completely off grid, I'm not sure if people would listen to me when I came to London to talk about the benefits of slowing down. It wouldn't chime. It wouldn't ring true. But because I am, I suppose, the person I am, that helps the message become more plausible, perhaps. That's seemed the way to me.
So being the person that you are and being sort of someone that isn't your typical kind of hippie, slowing down kind of person, how is it that you ended up writing these books and coming to this idea?
Well, like a lot of people, when you get stuck in fast forward, it often takes a shock to the system or a wake-up call, something to make you realize that you've forgotten how to put the brakes on, that this is doing real harm. I think for a lot of people, that wake-up call comes in the form of an illness. Just one day the body says, I cannot take the pace anymore. you have a heart attack, or you're a burnout, or you can't get out of bed one morning. Or maybe a relationship just goes up in smoke because you don't have the time or the tranquility to listen to the other person or be with them. My wake-up call came, thankfully, in a different way. It came when I started reading bedtime stories to my son, and I used to go into his room in those days and be unable to slow down. So I'd be sitting on his bed, one foot on the floor, speed reading Snow White, skipping lines, paragraphs, whole pages. I became an expert in what I dubbed the multiple page turn technique, where, you know, any parent out there will recognize that you get to the end of the page, you try and turn three or four, and it never works. You know, my son, like every four-year-old, knew the stories inside out, so he'd catch me every night. He'd say, well, Daddy, why are there only three dwarves in the story? You know, what happened to Grumpy? And I knew this was wrong. I mean, I had stories read to me as a child, and my parents did not speed read them in the way that I think we do in this roadrunner early 21st century. And for me, the wake-up call came when I found myself flirting with buying a book I'd read about in a newspaper. It was called The 1 Minute Bedtime Story. So someone had taken Snow White and all those classic tales and boiled them down to 60-second sound bites. And catching myself thinking that was a good idea was enough to jolt me into thinking, whoa, I've lost my bearings. I've lost my compass. I've lost my mind here. And that was for me the first step towards thinking, well, hang on, do I really need to do everything faster? Is that what life is all about? And that was the start for the whole adventure, I suppose.
So let's talk a bit about the book, because it's a fascinating premise. And the central premise is around finding the best way forward, not necessarily the fastest. And it reminds me of one of my favorite childhood fables, seeing as we're talking about childhood fables, about the tortoise and the hare. And I remember being really frustrated as a kid, because I definitely identified with a hare. And I always used to think, why is the hare just resting? Surely you'd want to finish the race and do other cool stuff. Anyway, so are there certain situations in which a fast fix is possibly better than a slow one? And how can we best learn to differentiate between the two?
Well, absolutely. I am not an extremist or a fundamentalist of slowness. You know, as I've already said, I love speed. And there are definitely times when a quick fix is just what the doctor ordered. If you're on a battlefield and a soldier is dying to death, you don't call for a Chinese herbalist, or you get in there and you administer, you know, whatever kind of shock medical treatment they do on the battlefield these days. Or if you're sitting across from a friend at dinner and that friend starts choking on a morsel of food trapped in their throat, you know, you don't sit back and stroke your chin and take the Aristotelian long view. You get up and deliver the Heimlich maneuver, right?
Yeah.
That is the quick fix that fits in that moment. The trouble, I think, is that we bring the spirit of the Heimlich maneuver, the Heimlich mindset, to every kind of problem. And that's the real trouble. That's when the problems set in. Because so many of the problems we face nowadays, whether it's with relationships, the workplace, medicine, politics, business, you name it, they are too complex. They are too different. They just do not respond to a Heimlich-style solution that simple. And I think it's, you know, I think almost intuitively we know that, but because we get stuck in roadrunner mode, we go faster and faster. We almost ignore the very obvious warning signs or symptoms that our solutions are not working. We just reach for the next plaster, the next duct tape, you know, the next pill to try to move on without dealing with the core of the problem, the roots. We just knock the symptoms on the head and move on quickly to the next thing.
So what's the most effective way that you've found personally to kind of figure out or feel your way through what the core issue of any given thing could be, if you're sort of running around slapping on plasters? I think my email inbox is almost a great example of that.
Yeah. Well, I feel your pain, because my email box is just the same as a constant barrage of electronic interruptions. There are lots of different ways into this and different tools and levers to pull. I think in some ways what it boils down to is the very age-old idea of taking time. I mean, you talked about that eternal story of the tortoise and the hare. I mean, it's that idea of not rushing. You know, if you've got a problem to confront, even if you just take stop when the problem is presented to you, and just take 2 or 3 minutes to let your mind wander around the problem, to go away from the problem and come back to your desk 5 minutes later, having let the mind daydream. You know, we know from what neuroscience is telling us that there are different types of thinking, there are different modes of thought, and to tap into that deeper, richer, more nuanced, more creative, more imaginative, more analytical, and often more accurate form of thinking, you do have to slow down. So I think a first step towards, you know, it's and these are old truths, right? What I'm saying here, these are ancient wisdoms. We have that old expression. It's woven into our vernacular, don't we? We talk about sleeping on a problem. Spend a night sleeping on it. And essentially what that is the same idea as the slow fix. It's saying, you know, there are times when you're going to have to shoot from the hip and come up with a solution that works right now, cobble something together that's going to get you through the next 3 minutes. But for many, many problems we face now, that those are not the exigencies. That's not what's required of us. We could take the time to sleep on it, or even just take 15 minutes away to let the mind drift, or to go ask a colleague, or put it out to a network of friends and get some feedback. So what it all comes down to is taking a bit more time than we're prone to taking at the moment.
Fascinating. Even in terms of the, I always think that habit is a very powerful thing, in terms of the morning habits that we get into, the way that you start your day. I remember talking with Narina Hertz, who has written a book on basically smarter decision thinking, decision making and thinking, and about how not to trust experts. And one of the things that she was talking about was the ability to just take half an hour of your day to bracket that into your day as a schedule, to just turn everything off, to not have your phone on, to not have your email on, to not have any push notifications. And I've started doing it just 10 minutes over breakfast. And it makes such a difference just to approach your day in that way, where you've got 10 minutes of downtime literally on an alarm clock scheduled in. So I know that for those 10 minutes, I can't do anything else. Do you find that you have to schedule time in for yourself so that you can block the invasive stuff out?
I think you do. I think that we're so wired now. We're so addicted to the next email, the next WhatsApp message, and the excitement and the dopamine squirt that delivers, that we do have to ring fence off time. We have to impose a discipline on ourselves. We almost have to, I mean, it sounds absurd, but I think we've reached this point. We have to schedule unscheduled time.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Half an hour and say, okay, nothing. I'm just going to let that half an hour happen. I'm going to block out all of the distractions and stimulations and acceleration points around me, and just go into that half an hour and go with the flow, and go where my mind wants to go, or explore what I want to explore, or mull over what needs to be mulled over. And no, I absolutely do that as well. I used to be somebody who was, to use that phrase of the moment, always on. But I'm no longer always on. You know, I will get back to people swiftly and promptly and very punctually. I think punctuality is very important. But that doesn't mean that you need to be reachable 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And, you know, again, it's big companies and people in some of the fastest sectors of the global economy are coming around to this idea. And Germany, Volkswagen, a couple of years ago, tweaked their server settings for their BlackBerrys, so staff BlackBerrys, so they can no longer send or receive email outside working hours.
Wow, that was brave.
You think that sounds more than brave? It sounds like a suicide act, is it? For an international company with a global supply chain. But of course, Volkswagen, you know, they realized that not everybody had to be connected and reachable every minute of every day. And they took a hard look, they slowed down, they looked at who really needed to be contactable outside of office hours, and shut everybody else off, so that even if they wanted to pester a colleague with an email at 9 at night, they couldn't do it.
Brilliant.
It's working a treat, because we all know this from our own lives, that those emails that we're glancing at dinner when we should be talking to our partner or our children, or that we're flicking through in our inbox at bed last thing at night, most of those emails are not that important or even that urgent, you know. And if people were forced to think about whether they need to send an email, or whether it made sense to wait till tomorrow, or allow events to overtake that email by going to sleep without logging on, we would realize that many of those emails just wouldn't need to be sent or looked at in the first place. So, you know, Volkswagen is one example of many. This is, I think, the beginnings of a tectonic shift in our approach to the technology and the gadgets. And we're starting to look for more and more ways to put speed limits on the information superhighway.
I think also it reminds me of this lovely idea, which is kind of what you're talking about with the BlackBerry, that these are things that we've created as tools to serve us, to help us live our lives better or more efficiently. And we've forgotten this fact, and we've kind of enslaved ourselves to the dopamine rush, to this kind of habitually fast-paced framework that just means that we just can't stop to slow down. And in one of your chapters, you allude to this, you use a wonderful French title, reculer pour mieux sauter, so it's which literally translates as moving backwards to jump better. Can you tell us a bit more about this idea?
Well, that's the chapter about, I think I built that one around a Norwegian shipping company, is that right? Yeah. I mean, that's, again, the simple idea of taking a pause, you know, to take the time to look at the big picture, to try and make sense of what's happened, to look backwards, to look forward. All of the things that go out the window when we react instead of reflect. And I think, in a sense, there's a meta point to be made here, that this is a culture that has lost the art of reflection. We are constantly wired into reaction. And as I said earlier, there are times when you do need to react. But so many of those difficult problems we face nowadays require reflection. They require us to think, to stop, to explore, to go down an avenue and find that that's a dead end and take the time to come back and find a fresh avenue of inquiry or path to move along. And all of that takes time. But I guess my argument is that people always say to us, you haven't got time for a slow fix. We have no money and no time for a slow fix. It has to be a quick fix. But if you think about it for a moment, we always find the time and the money later on to pick up the pieces when the quick fix of today blows up in our faces down the road. And I'm saying, why don't we just invert that equation and invest the time and the money and the resources and the energy now to start forging real, lasting, and meaningful solutions to problems instead of just hopping onto this carousel of quick fixes, which ultimately ends up wasting more time and more energy and more money than it would have done if we had opted to try, at least, to create a slow fix from the beginning.
How do you think that, because I know that you've got, sort of, is it one kid or two young kids?
I've got two children.
Two children. So how do you find this playing out in the younger generations and also at school? What do you think they're being taught at school? And do you think it's priming them to live their lives more slowly or more frenetically?
I think two things are happening for children now. One at the school front, in school systems around the world, including here in Britain, have become, over the last generation, high-speed assembly lines where kids are stuffed with academic learning younger and younger and then tested over and over again until exam scores become more important than learning itself. So I think something deeply neurotic and distorting is going on in our school classrooms nowadays. A lot of children are not really learning, and they're not learning how to think or take pleasure from ideas or knowledge or seeking wisdom. They are simply jumping through hoops, trying to get the next A star. And that's something that's very much on the radar for the biggest schools in the country. I mean, Eton College, one of the housemasters there got in touch with me a little while ago and said, we need to join forces to launch a slow education movement.
Brilliant.
I thought, whoa, you know, you're Eton. In a way, you may be one of the reasons the rest of us are running around trying to catch up, but you're the gold standard. And he said, well, you know, if we're the gold standard's wrong because our kids are racing through their childhoods instead of actually living them. So that's very much on the table for schools who are trying to roll it back. Outside the schools, I think the technology, of course, is accelerating everybody or helping everyone get faster and faster. And I think for a lot of kids, there's a sense that, I don't know, it's weird. They're more connected now electronically than ever before, but perhaps they're more alone. They have 321 friends on Facebook or Instagram, but when was the last time they spent a whole afternoon hanging out with one in the park? And you can see the young generation pushing back. There's this new trend now called stacking. I don't know if you've come across it.
It's phone stacking.
When young people go out, when young people go out to wherever, very young people, Nando's or, you know, in their 20s going to a pub, and they're there together. Everybody piles up their phone in a stack, and whoever reaches to check their phone first pays the bill for everyone around the table. And I think that's a sign that the young generation are saying, okay, we love Wi-Fi, we adore Instagram, we want to record and do selfies, but we also understand that the gadgets can get in the way and that we really want to connect more deeply with people in the real world. And we will never have these moments again, so let's not spoil them by trying to plug into four other moments at the same time. So, whenever new technology comes along, we always go overboard, and it takes time to work out the norms, social protocols, cultural rules, so we get the most out of it. At the moment, we are enslaved by our gadgets. I think, however, as an optimist, that we'll turn it around and learn how to get the right balance with them.
I certainly hope so. I think that the one thing that I'm somewhat worried about is this idea of being completely, constantly monitored and tracked and on. So these kind of things like Fitbits or, you know, the Google Glass or implants, that there may come a time in which we're all constantly being tracked, and it's very difficult to turn things off. So, for instance, even your phone. I remember looking into this in terms of when I was doing an article on privacy, the idea that even if you switch it off, it can still be tracked, or sort of moving into different territory here, but that it's very, very difficult to properly, fully, entirely switch off. And to do that, it's almost harder than to switch on. So it's become almost like instead of opting in, we have to kind of opt out. So it's become normal to be completely plugged in at all times, and therefore much more difficult to take ourselves away from that, what seems to be natural state.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly become the norm. And as social creatures who like to fit in and feel a lot of status anxiety, we don't like deviating from the norm. No. You know, we don't want to leave the herd. Mm. But as the herd becomes more and more neurotic, burnt out and unhappy, the herd will start to drift in a new direction. And I kind of think that we're starting in that phase now that, even if you see just recently this whole scandal over Edward Snowden and what he's revealed the NSA in the United States and security services in Britain have been doing. I mean, this is appalling. I mean, they are pulling apart and trampling all over our basic human rights. And, there's a point where people will stop looking at box sets of, the West Wing and or whatever and start standing up and saying, this is just not acceptable.
Yeah.
And I do think that we can already see that starting to happen. But as you say, we are, in a sense, painted into a corner on this. And we've got so accustomed to just giving away our data online and letting Google follow us wherever we go and Facebook track all of our likes and dislikes, it has been normalized. But I do think that episodes like the Snowden whistleblow, these things shine a light on dark corners that I think when we take the time to look at them are deeply, deeply alarming. And, there will be a new debate. There's a new debate already happening.
Yeah, I watched actually quite recently the talk that Edward Snowden gave at TED and then the NSA's reply. Very fascinating. And I think whether you love him or hate him, I think the fact that he's created the space to have the conversation, much as you have done with your three books, that's telling that people are actually gravitating towards these ideas and actually getting involved. One of the things I really liked in your book, that sort of I skimmed through, I haven't yet had the joy to read the chapter, but you quote Aristotle, and the text that you quote is, "The action that follows deliberation should be quick, but deliberation should be slow." In the light of all we know about how we make decisions and the fact that most of our motivations lie beneath the level of conscious awareness, how do you think slowing down our deliberation process can help us make better decisions in everyday life?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that Aristotle said that so, so long ago.
Yeah.
I mean, it was way before Wi-Fi and just-in-time management. But it's something I think that has always been with us, because the brain that we've inherited from early man living out there in the savannah is still the same brain, right? Mm. And it's a brain that has those two, people often refer to them as system one and system two thinking. System one being the shoot from the hip, the instant call, the intuitive or blink or whatever word you want to hang on it. And system two being the slower, more energy demanding, analytical, more reflective kind of thinking.
Mm.
And really the secret for any kind of not only problem solving, but for living a good life, is to shift gears back and forth between the two and have those two systems in balance. It seems to me that as a culture, we're stuck in a kind of system one rut where we tend to go for that one type of thinking. And often system one, I mean, the thing about system one, those very quick intuitive decisions, they can be very accurate, but they're not always accurate, right? So you've got to take the time to check them afterwards and be sure they're okay. But in order, even before that, to guarantee that they are as accurate as they can be, you have to spend a lot of time building up your experience around whatever it is that decision is. So that's why experts tend to make, generally speaking, of course they make mistakes too, but they tend to be better at quick decisions within their area of expertise, because they've taken a lot of time, a lot of slow time, they've slowed down to get to know the nitty-gritty, the texture, all of the nuances, all of the backstories, the whole database surrounding their area of expertise, so that when it comes time to make a quick decision, they're better equipped to do it. Doesn't make them flawless. Doesn't mean they're perfect. Doesn't mean that we don't have to keep an eye on their decisions and check them and sift them as well. But that kind of interplay of fast and slow, I think, is at the heart of this idea of the slow fix. Because, of course, a slow fix isn't necessarily always slow. You know, sometimes it is a very quick moment. Like Aristotle said, in the moment, you deliver something quickly. But in order to deliver that quick decision accurately, a sensible decision, you have to have taken the time to slow down in advance before to prepare yourself. Or the military the U.S. military talk about that as well. The importance of what's that expression I use in the book? Piss poor, or lack of. It's seven P's. I'm going to forget the acronym, but something along the lines of, you know, if you don't prepare, you're going to have piss poor performance or something.
Oh, brilliant!
Like that. And I think that's very much the case. You know, it's that's a very salty, you know, vernacular way to put it, but it's a similar sort of idea that you've got to take the time and slow down in advance to get there, to be able to do it in the moment when you need to be quick. It's in a sense, because if we just backpedal and look at the big picture again, slow, when you talk about slow, not just slow problem solving, but slow food, slow sex, slow work, slow medicine, slow exercise, whatever you hang slow on, it always boils down to the same thing, the idea of doing things at the right speed, sometimes fast, sometimes slower, that relearning the lost art of shifting gears between speeds, or when you bring it back to problem solving, shifting gears between system one and system two.
So finding the right pace at the right time for the kind of outcome that you want, I suppose, or the kind of experience that you want.
Exactly. And in order to do that, you've got to remember that patience is still a virtue.
Yes, I can
even
definitely
in the 21st
relate
century,
to that.
Oh, actually, I would say especially the 21st century, because we need it now more than ever.
Yeah. It's funny, I've had friends who've started doing emails in batches. You know, when you start seeing people's emails responses and it's an automated response that says, I check my emails in two batches at 12 o'clock and then at 4 o'clock, and I'll get back to you then. And that people are kind of trying to build this in so that for those things you were saying earlier about not having important or urgent emails. And you often find that if you do that, then by the time the person reads the email and then they finally get back to you, by the time they get back to you, they've solved their issue anyway. If they'd have just taken the time to think it through, they wouldn't have needed to send the email to begin with.
Well, it's a bit like what Volkswagen have discovered. It's the same phenomenon. People do slow down often. They realize, because this is the problem now. It's so seductive. It's so easy to send an email that we send it off without unthinkingly. So on top of that, we often rope everyone else in the office in with CCs and BCCs, and we end up just in turning email becomes a weapon of mass distraction, which is not really very much use for anybody in the workplace or even at home in your private life.
Yeah, no, it's and actually at home it's terrible. You've got to just turn the phone off. I find that if I don't turn things off, then no one ends up spending any time with one another, which is quite sad actually. In chapter 12, I wanted to ask you, I've got three more questions I want to squeeze in. You explore this fascinating idea of twiddling the emotional thermostat, which I think is a gorgeous turn of phrase. And you start by writing about persuading people to donate their organs after death. When it comes to such, I want to say, kind of emotionally charged topics, can you tell us a bit more about how a slow fix approach can help us to take better actions?
Yeah, I suppose in a sense, my view, again, looking at the big picture, is that we've moved into a culture that puts such a premium on mathematics, on the digital, on binary, on this notion that somehow we can, there's an algorithm for everything.
Oh God, it's all sort of scientism.
It is a little bit like that, a kind of scientism mechanistic tyranny that's running our culture at the moment. And I guess what I'm saying in that chapter is that way lies all kinds of unhappiness and failure, because when we want to solve most of the problems confronting us today, there's a human dimension. And no matter how hard people may want it to be so, or how hard people may write their algorithms in Silicon Valley, you human beings are not algorithmical. You know, we are gloriously and eternally mysterious, tangled, unpredictable, and emotional. And so I guess the point of that chapter was to make the argument that whenever you're addressing any kind of problem, whether it's trying to get people to donate their organs after the death of their loved ones, or turn around a failing company, or fix a broken school, you've got to take stock of how people feel in the moment. You've got to bring people along with you. And of course, just backpedaling a little here, emotions cannot be accelerated, right? Those kind of human contacts, building trust, persuading people, listening, you know, you cannot listen faster. Rush you're in. You cannot listen faster. You simply can't do it. You've got to find the tempo, the rhythm of the other person. They've got to feel that you're there, and then they open up. All that stuff, this is all slow in its purest form. So I guess what I was trying to say in that chapter is that no matter how much of a rush you're in, you know, human beings are slow. I mean, there's a quote from Einstein somewhere floating around as well that he says, you know, machines are incredibly fast, and human beings are incredibly slow. And there's a kind of truth in that, I think, that and for both, the speed and the slowness are the source of their strength. So it's about honoring the human element in problem solving and understanding that part of that means taking time, taking, you know, slowing things down.
So in terms of slowing things down and looking forwards, at the end of the book, you start talking about slow fixing the future. What's the single most important way, if I might be so bold, in which you think that we could possibly do this?
Oh, gosh, that's
a bit of a tricky question. I'm sorry.
Yeah, single most.
Or maybe your favorite one.
Yeah. In some ways, I guess probably the first chapter that I look at when I look at all these different ingredients of slow fix is the importance of admitting failure. And I think that is so often, I put that as the first chapter because it seemed to me that that was so often the opening salvo when it came to solving a difficult problem or making headway in it. That, you know, in this culture where we're constantly bigging ourselves up and painting perfect portraits of our lives on Facebook and shouting how wonderful we are in our CVs on LinkedIn and so on, you know, it's hard for people to say, you know what, I don't know the answer to that, or I made a mistake. But yet, when you take the time to do that and to deal with the emotional fallout that comes with admitting to mistakes and a mea culpa, you actually find that that opens up all kinds of doors to new lines of inquiry, new ways of thinking about the problem, and very often new and better solutions. And in fact, when you go back through the annals of, you know, history, you go back through all the artists, great scientists, great innovators in business, they've not talked about mistakes or failures as being the end point or being some kind of terribly pejorative phenomenon that you've got to avoid and sweep under the carpet. They've actually referred to them by and large as stepping stones. Mm-hmm. You know, you embrace the mistake and you move on and learn from it. And I think that's something that in a way we've kind of lost in this airbrushed perfect score 10 society. And I think that if I had to choose one thing, I would say we have to remember how to be humble. You know, I was talking earlier about patience still being a virtue.
Yeah.
When you go back to the old virtues, humility is also on that list, isn't it? And I think that's a very important starting point, because if we're going to break out of the mess we're in at the moment, we're going to have, first and foremost, to admit that what we're doing now is wrong.
Yeah.
So that's going to be our first step, I suppose.
Oh, what a lovely, lovely note to end on. So before I say goodbye to you, I have rather a frivolous end round, which is a group of quick fire questions. So five either or questions, and I'm afraid that these are not slow.
And they're not negotiable either, I'm guessing.
And they're non-negotiable.
It's either yes or no.
Yeah, or quick and okay. Absolute. So they're all the things that we don't like about scientists, well, or in the right position that we do.
Probably can't hear it, but I'm switching into system one as we speak.
Brilliant. Okay, system one is go. Okay, so Star Trek or Star Wars?
Star Trek.
Oh, good. Borg assimilation or death?
Sorry?
Borg assimilation or death?
Death.
Death. Yay, me too. Relative or absolute?
Relative.
Starter or dessert?
Starter.
Neuroscience or psychology?
Neuroscience.
Fascinating. Thank you so much, Carl. For everyone listening, if you'd like to tweet to Carl, which I'm sure you'll have some questions for him, you can find him at Carl Honoré using the hashtag GoodBadDirty. And Carl, are there any things that you would like people to check out on the show notes page? I'm going to add the link to your Twitter and to your website and to the three books that I've mentioned. Is there anything else that you think they should be checking out online?
Well, I would probably recommend going to my website, which is a good primer for all things slow. So there are plenty of links to all the different kinds of mini slow movements. There's lots of audio and video, and it's just a good place to get the ball rolling.
Fantastic. And that is carlhonoré.com, and I shall post the link on the site. Carl, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a delicious, slow pleasure.
That's the best kind.
And hopefully I will get to see you over coffee sometime.
Look forward to it. Many thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you like this episode, make sure you go to my website, thewebpsychologist.com/show-notes, to get links to all the resources we mentioned, as well as updates on future shows. Thanks for listening.